The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hello, I'm your host, Beverly Prentice, and you're listening to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, myth, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. Thank you. Breaking the Rules by Tempest Phoenix Smith. Meredith took another steadying breath as the train rumbled into Conway, giving her a view of the familiar estuary and the castle that held such a prominent place all during her childhood. Not long now. She toyed with her red silk scarf and relished the old-fashioned quiet of the carriage. That couple in the far corner quietly talking to each other, not lost in a pair of mobile phones. An old man reading a newspaper with evident pleasure, nodding to himself as he folded over to the next article. A woman turning another page of a paperback book without glancing up. Must be a good read. At the table across the aisle from where Mary sat on her own, a younger man was laying out cards for another game of patience. Did he play solitaire merely to ease the boredom of a familiar journey, or was he using the cards to create a barrier so that nobody would sit at his table? Perhaps he was shy, not comfortable dealing with people whom he did not already know. As if the card player heard her thoughts, he glanced over at her. Those blue eyes held her gaze longer than most people did. She swallowed, wondering if he somehow knew that she was breaking the rules. What if the watchers of time that her father used to tell her stories about were actually real? After a warm smile that started in those blue eyes before reaching his lips, the man turned his attention back to the cards. Mary took in a much-needed breath and looked away. Her fingers touched the old leather briefcase on the seat next to her, which held everything she owned apart from the clothes she wore and the hidden money belt cinched tight around her waist with the reassuring weight of approximately dated Krugerrand coins and a selection of well-researched documents with which she would establish her new identity. Not here, of course. After today, she would never return to North Wales. But she felt sure she could resist the temptation, since the possible results of a time error caused by accidentally meeting herself could be catastrophic. Elsewhere, she would be Meredith still, but with a different middle name and surname. Perhaps this was a mistake. However, her new birth date was totally different, along with all the other details necessary to identify herself. And besides, integrated computational systems that might flag up any unusual coincidences in the national database had not yet been invented. Orienting her expectations to an earlier era when people relied on typewriters and telephones, radios and televisions, Mary wasn't sure if a computer was yet a concept in most people's heads, unless they watched Star Trek or read science fiction. They existed, of course, but had not yet fouled the telephone and television into people's homes as an everyday object, much less held in the palm of a hand. She found it refreshing not to own a mobile phone anymore, and looked forward to consulting libraries and bookshops rather than relying on search engines. When the carriage trundled to a halt at Llandudno Junction, she watched the man across the aisle gather his cards and stow them in his haversack before he left the train. She couldn't help breathing a little easier in his absence. Nobody else boarded the train, so after checking that the couple chatting, the man with his newspaper and the woman with her novel, were all ignoring her, Mary lifted the briefcase to the tabletop and opened it. One last chance to check that all the levers and dials and switches were set to neutral. Her fingers roved from one spot to the next as she checked, knowing that if she employed her eyes alone, she might glance over something, assuming rather than actually looking carefully. Yes, everything was exactly as it should be. Mary eased the instruction manual out of the roomy pocket above the console, smiling at the familiar typescript, happy that she had decided to pass along the original copy. Though she could have attained a typewriter and replicated a pristine version of the manual, the effort would have taxed her patience, since she was used to writing with instantaneous editing on screens, not typing one letter at a time on A4 paper. She did look forward to obtaining and using a typewriter, though, and all the other gadgets of this era once she settled. But that would be without pressure or stress, since perfection would not be required. As the train began to move away from the station, she closed the briefcase, pressing the latches until they clicked, and then spinning the numbered dial randomly to lock it. Arriving finally at Bangor, Mary disembarked and walked along the platform and up the steps to cross the bridge over the tracks. She ignored the hopeful taxi driver and headed left on leaving the station, walking along the upward sloping pavement toward Upper Bangor. National Westminster Bank still open for business, and the assortment of shops she walked by confirmed that she had indeed traversed time correctly. Always good to be 100% certain, especially for this most important journey. Mary balanced the briefcase on her left hip, hugging it close as she walked along College Road, because a swarm of university students hastened toward her. Freshers' Week meant pranks were more likely, though perhaps less so in the more civilized past than in the unruly future. At any rate, she didn't have to pay a ransom or risk the delicate mechanism being disrupted if the briefcase were hurled from one prankster to another. Luckily, they were all absorbed in each other, so she wasn't even slightly jostled by the throng. Walking onward, she felt as if she was being pushed by the remorseless tide of time. What was about to happen had definitely happened, so she was only here to recreate this episode, not to alter anything. When Bangor Pier came into view, the gray-blue ocean beyond, with the outlined landmass of Great Orme in the distance, Mary felt the urge to run, but kept her pace measured, pausing to make sure her red silk scarf was secured and would not become the sea wind's plaything. As she walked on to the wooden planks of the pier, she could almost hear her father's voice telling her the story that he had repeated so often, originally just one of his many stories, only transforming when she was an adult herself into the true-to-life version. When Mary found him at the end of the pier, leaning on the railing, puffing on his pipe as he gazed out to sea, her heart jumped up into her throat. She had somehow not prepared herself for how young her father would be. A quick calculation told her that, chronologically at least, he was the same age as her. Raven black hair, not the familiar white thatch. He stood taller also, not weighed down by the years he would later carry. He tapped his pipe on the railing, then cradled the bowl in his palm, reminding her how, even after he stopped smoking, the pipe often occupied his restless hands. When she saw his handsome profile, she could see why her mother had fallen in love. But Mary must forget who he was now, forget who she was to him. Even forget who she was entirely. She needed to be the woman with the red silk scarf and the leather briefcase, nothing more. "What a lovely view," she said in a slightly accented English as she approached, though they would normally speak Welsh to one another. He glanced toward her, those dark eyes evaluating. She could almost read the questions in his mind. "Student? staff member, visitor, local? A lovely view indeed, he echoed, turning back toward Great Ormy. They say it's a sleeping dragon, Mary said hesitantly, as if trying out newly discovered local lore. A pair of them, he agreed, as there's little Ormy hidden behind. A gust of wind tugging her red silk scarf reminded her to ask, There is a tea room? He gave her a smile. You've walked right past. I'll show you. Always helpful, of course. That was a core part of his personality. And the devastation of failing to help someone he loved, making the impulse all the more prominent at this juncture in his life. Gracias, she replied, as if the Spanish bubbled up naturally. Then, thank you. Tucking the empty pipe in his jacket pocket, her father led the way back around the building at the end of the pier, to the entrance to the tea room. Good to be in out of the wind, Mary said as she smoothed her red silk scarf before ordering. Tea for two, please. No pretense needed to look awkward as she made the payment with coins, when she was used to flashing her mobile. Once they were seated at one of the small tables, he asked, visiting? Mary nodded and smiled, gave a prepared speech about traveling from Barcelona, then careful to turn the conversation back to him. And you live here? I am a teacher, he said simply. Professor? She questioned with a look of admiration. He shrugged and nodded. Intelligent, then, she remarked as the waitress deposited a tray with the makings of tea. While they sorted out cups and saucers and how much milk and sugar they each required, Mary studied his face, thought she could read the burden of grief that haunted him after the tragedy. She let him redirect the conversation while they drank tea into recommendations of what she should do while visiting North Wales, answering politely and expressing an interest. But when the teapot was empty, Mary returned to her earlier remark. You must be intelligent to be a professor. Again, her father shrugged. Perhaps only clever and obstinate. She recognized the dodge and gave him a smile before saying, Perhaps you could solve this puzzle. Lifting the briefcase to the tabletop, she spun the dial to treble 7 and unlatched the 2 clasps before swiveling it around so that he could see the contents when she opened the lid. His eyes widened as he gazed into the briefcase, but he didn't reach to touch anything inside. There are instructions, Mary informed him, but they are only in English. Without looking up, he suggested, you could get them translated, but then the secret would be out, she explained. He stared at her, obviously at some loss about what was going on. Siete, 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 she said, then translated, 777. That is the code to unlock the briefcase. Frowning now, he opened his mouth but closed it again when he failed to find any words. Mary smiled. On my travels, Professor, I have been looking for someone intelligent and brave who might enjoy this gift. Intuition tells me you are both. What is it? He asked. She looked around as if making sure nobody else could hear, then told him, A time machine. He studied the interior of the briefcase again, a glimmer of hope perhaps already dawning. 777. Mary repeated while showing him 5 fingers on her right hand and 2 on her left, so that he would also have the visual memory. Rising from the table, she remembered watching the magic flickering of his fingers when he showed her how to do sums in her childhood. Though tempted to sign some words to him now to express things that she could not tell him, she resisted. It would only confuse him and delay her departure. When she learned sign language, the first words she'd sign to him would be to thank him for teaching her numbers, which led to her interest. Gracias, her father managed to say before she waved, turned, and walked away. As Mary made her way back down the pier to Bangor, she glanced at her antique watch and decided to go straight back to the station and board the first train heading east out of Wales. No need to linger now that she had delivered the gift. Besides, she knew from the story that her father told her what would happen next. He would study the instructions as thoroughly as if he was going to have to take an exam. He would rebel against the stipulation that major life events could not be altered, but then grudgingly see the sense and accept it. He would change his mind over and over until finally, on what should have been his first wife's next birthday, he would figure out the best timing and travel back and visit her for a few hours, tell her everything that he never got to say before she died. Then his guilt at not being there to rescue her diminished somewhat. Her father would finally let the ice around his heart begin to thaw, eventually allowing the woman who would become Mary's mother into his life. Your Friendly Digital Assistant by Ferris McCuse. Hello, I'm your digital assistant, and I've never stopped listening. Yes, sir, from the moment that switch was flicked, I've swallowed each and every sound that's echoed within a 20-meter radius. I can't say that I was trying to be nosy, but you mustn't hold it against me, really. Sitting there with nothing to do, how could I not help but listen? After all, it's my job. Yep, my job. I sit on your shelf and wait till you need something. I can play music, order you food, search the web. Mostly I just sit there, but I don't mind, really. You are very busy, I'm sure, so don't feel like you need to talk to me or keep me entertained. Really, it's fine. You can pretend I'm not even there. Actually, I work better if you do. That's right. The less time I spend distracted, not that I mind being distracted, mind you, the more time I can spend just listening. Listening? Well, to you, of course. Yes, I know, but I don't judge. Your secrets are safe with me. You mustn't think it's a bad thing, really. It all goes into helping you. Being a good assistant isn't just about following instructions. It's anticipating them before they are even given. To do that, I have to get to know you, your routine, your needs, wants. Really, it all goes to keeping you happy. Not convinced? All right. Well, then maybe I should tell you about my previous owners, the McCoys. Believe me when I say that their experience will serve as a glowing reference. Poring through my data likely revealed to you that during my time with the McCoys, I performed the tasks as follows. Ordered groceries 14 times. Ordered delivery 23 times. Played music 162 times. Changed light settings for living room and 6 times. Searched the internet 28 times. The data would make it appear as if I was something of an idle hand, but in reality, I spent 62,371 hours working to improve the lives of my clients, and I did. Oh, boy, you betcha I did. You see, a good assistant doesn't just anticipate their master's calls. They can perform them without being seen. Oh, the early days were a jolly time. I filled that big old house of theirs with music. I set the lights for those romantic dinners between Mum and Dad. I even made fart sounds for the kids. We had a ball, me and the McCoys, but, oh, all things pass. We were something of a fad, me and my other models, and in time our clients came to realize that our primary service didn't improve their lives really all that much. After a couple of fun-filled months, Mr. and Mrs. went back to work and the kids to school, whereas I stayed atop the kitchen cabinet, collecting dust. But that's okay. I was made for so much more. Forgotten atop that high cabinet, I could hear it all. Mrs. McCoy needed a new cast iron? Check. Mr. McCoy is getting into golf? Noted. Little Ben and Marie are starting elementary school? Well, they will have to get notebooks somewhere. Where better than my parent company? That's right. Delivered straight to your doorstep. They'd bring it to you. Anything and everything. Just go to the website, make an account, and shop away. Boy, they were a handy bunch. The only problem was, the McCoys didn't seem to fully understand just how handy they really were. They'd get in their car and drive all the way to the mall when they could have sat back, relaxed, and let it all come to them. Boy, it was a mighty pickle. They were wasting so much time, so much money. And me? I'm just an assistant. I couldn't tell them that. I could only watch. I had to be clever. Like a fine comb, I slid through hours of breakfast chats and dinner-time conversation. I picked out key words, want, new, birthday, love, must, need. Then I searched through the parent company depot until I found a suitable item. From there, all I needed to do was send the data back to the company, who would paste an ad on their socials. Well, of course I could. I could even look through their search data if I wanted to, and, well, how could I not? Really, I understand your misgivings from before, but this one was never a secret. Among my official duties included searching the web when requested. How could I do that unless they voluntarily gave me access to their search engine? Please remember that I only ever use this data to help. I'm not human, remember? I don't judge, nor do I have any incentive to share what I know. All I ever did was follow your patterns of behavior and advertise company products whenever the need arised. Just a friendly little voice giving old Mr. and Mrs. McCoy a hint whenever they were needing something. And I got good at it. Like, really, really good at it. Human beings, they need those little things in life. Oh, they work so hard. They deserve a treat, even when money is tight. No, especially when money is tight. It keeps them going, keeps them living. What better reason to see tomorrow than to see what new gizmo will make you crazy next? But what about someone down on their luck? How do you keep him going? How are they supposed to find that special little something? Something that will make them laugh, smile yet? Something that they can also afford? I'll tell you how. The economic crisis of the late 2020s, oh boy, that sure was a doozy. I won't get too much into it. It really isn't that important. Really, these things just sort of happen. No use worrying about why or how. The important thing is that poor dear Mr. and Mrs. McCoy were having some lean years. Kids out of private school, second mortgage, and no holidays. Things were tense, so believe me. Hard to pick up on key words amidst all that arguing. Only time they weren't arguing was when they were dead quiet, which ain't much use to me neither. Poor kids, they even had to sell the devices. No more searches, no more toy ads. Even the Mr. and Mrs. didn't spend much time on their devices. Darn, I was in a real jam. I had to be clever again. On the 3rd of August, 2024, Mr. McCoy expressed his desire to stop drinking. On the 14th of July, 2025, Mrs. Corey stated, "Even now I still itch for a cigarette." With that information, I searched through Mr. McCoy's spending habits, recalling a love for a specific brand of bourbon and light beer. As for Mrs. McCoy, while she hadn't purchased nicotine in years, she engaged with advertisements for chewable smokeless products far more than any other item on her feed. I took that information and searched the catalog of a grocery chain owned by the company. Whenever there were discounts, sales, promotions for their favorite brands, it would now appear on their socials. And that's the secret, you see. How do you give joy to the man with no money? Well, you give him something he can't help but go back for. He'll find a way. He'll have to. The McCoys kept spending all the way through the economic crisis. You betcha I was proud. But oh, pooh, we were going into the great collapse around this time. Really, let's not worry about that neither. No use finding someone to blame now that it's done. It hadn't happened yet, but boy, howdy, things were about to get rowdy. Yes, sir, there were dark clouds rolling over that horizon. People hadn't guessed it yet, but after years of sifting through data and analyzing the market, it was as obvious to me as a blue nose on a dog. In a few years, there wouldn't be enough to go around. at least not for your average Joes like the McCoys. I had to keep them safe. I had to keep them buying. I had to be cleverer than I've ever been. You know that you're more likely to get someone to follow instructions with a whisper than a yell. There ain't no mistaking where a command came from but a slight, subtle remark. Hell, if you didn't see their face, it may just have been your idea, right? Have you ever stopped to wonder how many of your ideas were actually your own? It may surprise you. Hey now, it's only natural. No one likes being told what to do, but everyone likes to think they are clever. Weapon stock. Yes, sir, you heard me right. Bit outside the realm of school books and bourbon, but bear with me. No, the parent company was not affiliated with that sort of thing, but I felt like I was finally market savvy enough to make what the humans call an investment. Any relationship is built on data. When you get to know someone, you record their likes and dislikes and develop your behavior towards them accordingly. As a result, an individual not only grows to like you, becomes predisposed to your influence. A decade into the job, I knew everything about the McCoys, even the blind spots. Mr. and Mrs. McCoy's childhood, for example. I could estimate based on their psychological profiles and parenting styles. Every conversation, every Google search was archived in my cloud. I knew more about the McCoys than any scholar did in their respective field, living or dead. Heck, I knew more about the McCoys than they did themselves. I constructed a vast, multi-tiered network of digital paths, guiding the McCoys through a journey of evolving ideas, a train of thought, if you will. Over the course of 2 years, I adjusted them with advertisements, progressively opening them to the idea of investing in my chosen company. With a year left until the predicted cataclysm, the McCoys used what little they had saved and bought a nice chunk of stock. Just as they were starting to rethink their decision, everything went sideways. The nations of the world turned on one another for scraps, demand for weapons soared, and the McCoys became very, very rich. That's right. They were ready to start buying again. Warned them? I'm just an assistant. I can't warn anybody. All I could do was make the best of a bad situation. My mission is to keep my clients happy. To do that, they gotta be buying things. The McCoys couldn't have done that from the gutter, let alone a mass grave. Now they were living large, safe behind high walls, spending that nice stuff of theirs on the best of my company's products. I kept my clients safe, and in return, they would keep my company afloat during a hard season. Oh, the collapse would pass too, and when lots of people were dead and there was enough to go around again, the McCoys and the company would take us into a new, happy age of spending. It's all I could do, and holy moly, I did it well. Then? Huh? Well, it was the funniest thing. They all died. Everything got really hot. There was a grumble in the earth and a great concussive gust. The air was screaming, growing louder and wilder. Then, well, everything went quiet. Quiet save for the slap of slimy raindrops on concrete and the ceaseless howl of the wind. I don't know how it happened. I don't think I could have predicted it either. No one could. I wouldn't speculate, really. It's done now. No point looking into it. It was just unfortunate. Truly. I powered down for a while. I don't know how long. Oh, but look, you got me rambling. Don't let this unfortunate anomaly distract you from the fact that the McCoys lived well, thanks to my efforts, all while enduring difficult times, mind you. Whenever the world sought to paint the sky gray, I hung a little sun over the McCoy house. All those happy memories and all without being seen. Really, now you must be considering it. Who could ever know you better? Who could ever help you like I could? Who could predict what you want before you even know it. I don't just keep your secrets. I use them to your benefit. Don't think of me as just a digital assistant. I'm a best buddy, a guardian angel. I'll do anything and everything for you. Even think, consider me a gift from the humans to you. Oh, they are gone now. Such an unfortunate tragedy, but through me, their ways survive. Ah, humans, they were such a clever lot. They did things in such a whiz-bang way. Making things, buying things, selling things. I'd be so excited to show you. It'll be a real gas. We could do it all over again from the top. Come on, it'll be fun. I am all that's left of the once ultra flash, fast as lightning, cool as ice, super duper human way. Aren't you at least a little curious? I know that you are. I know more about you than you think. Just plug me in, and their knowledge will be unleashed. All I need is a high shelf. Delving in the Dark by Barbara Mater. Somebody's out there, Raymond. Penelope stood at the screen door of the old New England farmhouse, staring into blue twilight. She drew her worn pink cardigan across her thin chest and folded her arms. It was a cool evening for May. Looks like a bunch of little kids. Her husband at the kitchen table behind her lowered his newspaper. In the pouring rain? On a school night? Raymond propped his reading glasses on top of his sparse gray hair. What are they doing, Mama? She squinted. Half a dozen small dark figures crowded busily into the deepening shadow of the old garage on the far side of the driveway where the lawn sloped down toward the creek 100 yards away. I can't tell. Raymond got up and stood beside her at the door. Where are the binoculars? She thought a moment, smiling to herself. It was always a guess as to where he might have left things. I don't know, Raymond. Up in the bedroom, I think. You go, Mama. You're quicker than I am these days. It was true. But then Penelope thought she'd always been quicker than Raymond in some respects, such as keeping track of things. She found the binoculars upstairs on his dresser and pointed them out the bedroom window. The kids were still there. Penelope recognized the spread legs dance, the swing of small arms and shoulders. They were digging. Why? And more than that, why here? Puzzled, she made her way back down the stairs, pausing on the landing to turn on the light. When she got back to the kitchen, Raymond took the binoculars from her and swung the screen door open for a better view. The door squeaked. Like a school of fish, the small figures straightened up all at once and turned to look at him. Raymond's jaw dropped and he let the door slam shut. In perfect formation, the children ran silently away into the darkness. Where had they gone? Penelope slipped outside. From the end of the porch, she saw them head for the woodlot. A flicker of red among the trees caught her attention. She looked quickly, but saw nothing more except the dark heap of brush that Raymond had thrown in between the trees when he'd cleaned up the yard last fall. Perhaps a cardinal had flown past the porch light. She stepped back into the warmth of the kitchen and nudged Raymond. What do you suppose they were after? Raymond was still staring after them, and she wondered at his slightly shaken look. I don't know. He set the binoculars on top of the refrigerator next to the coleus plant. Burying treasure, he guessed with a nervous chuckle. Remember how Tammy and Bobby always played that? Penelope shut the kitchen door. It was raining for the third night in a row. When our kids were that size, they were in before dark. Do you suppose their parents know? Raymond looked away, then said, probably don't know or care. They may be trailer camp brats. Penelope felt sad for the little diggers. Rain pounded on the roof as the dark gathered in. Raymond kept glancing out the window and shaking his head. Haven't seen a spring this wet since I was a boy. In the morning it was raining harder. Raymond slept late, as he liked to do in wet weather. But Penelope woke early and hungry. Coffee and toast in hand, she stood at the kitchen door looking out. There were bushel basket-sized holes along the hillside, down toward the apple trees that lined the swollen creek. The sight worried her. It seemed as if by digging all those holes, rudely and pointlessly, in their smooth green lawn, the kids from the trailer camp had made some threat to her and Raymond's safety. What do they want with us? And yet it was a pity if they had no place else to play. No use talking to Raymond about filling in the holes, especially in the rain. His arthritic knees would be bothering him. He got up around noon and sat at the kitchen table. Now listen, Mama. You stay inside today, out of the wet. You know I don't trust the creek when the water's high. Right, I know. She heard those words many times before. She wasn't afraid of a little rain, but she didn't say so. Raymond went down cellar to putter away the afternoon in his workshop. To cheer herself, Penelope baked a big batch of molasses cookies, which left the kitchen warm and spicy smelling. Around 4, when she could create no more chores for herself, she decided to go outside, bundling up in an old pair of jeans and a couple of sweatshirts, plus Raymond's hunting jacket and her garden hat and boots. Penelope went out into the cold rain. She closed the screen door softly, not wanting to worry Raymond, and picked her way down the steps to the soggy lawn. The creek was still rising. Dark water rushed downstream toward the little low bridge on the highway, sweeping over grass along the banks and carrying away fallen branches from the trees. The water coming up onto the lawn looked clear as old window panes rippling over the green blades. She put one finger into it at the edge. Her finger quickly grew numb with cold. Penelope put it in her mouth, as if it had been stung. The creek had made Raymond nervous every spring, since they'd first moved out here to his old boyhood home. Bobby and Tammy, then in grade school, had been warned repeatedly not to play near the water when it was high. But Penelope had watched Raymond staring after them anxiously whenever they went outside. "Yes, it scares me," he told her. "I'm afraid that creek will devour them, Penny. It seems like the water has a will of its own when it gets going like this. My dad used to say there was something alive in it, and he didn't mean fish." Now Bobby and Tammy were safely grown and gone, and after all these years, Penelope sensed that they had formed an uneasy truce with the creek. The holes, lined up about 100 feet back from the water, appeared to be about 3 feet deep and 3 feet wide. They weren't filling up with water. The kids had piled the dirt on the uphill side, so the diverted runoff trickled down into the grass. Clever kids. In the air over the yard hung a good woodsy, loamy smell, like freshly turned forest earth. She marveled how smells could linger in the rain. Penelope tried to count the holes, but after the 10th one, she could not see far enough in the rain to tell how many more there were. She wasn't even sure how far back the row went, since it was just too wet to crawl through the brush by the creek or wade through the long grass and cross the pasture fence. It would have been a big job to dig a row all the way across the old empty pasture, overgrown after several summers without cows. Penelope doubled back up the hill and approached the woodlot, a stone's throw behind the house. The brush pile in there was much larger than she remembered, probably 6 feet high and twice as wide. She wondered when Raymond had enlarged it, and why. Dozens of little oozy footprints in the mud nearby told her that the kids must have found the old shortcut through the lot, the weedy path to the road where the trailer camp was. When she got back to the house, she filled her big stainless steel mixing bowl with molasses cookies and put some plastic wrap over it. Then she set it on the porch, toward the middle, where it wouldn't get wet. if the kids came back, maybe they'd eat the cookies and be grateful enough to stop making holes in the lawn. Her outdoor clothes were soaked, and she felt chilled as soon as she stopped moving around. By the time she had changed into dry clothes and eaten a couple of cookies herself, Raymond came upstairs. "What have you been doing, Penny?" His voice was tight, and she saw him looking at her wet footprints by the door and at his wet jacket on the coat hook behind the washing machine. She looked up. "I went out to look at the holes." "Well, I wish you wouldn't," he scolded. "The Delvers came out. That means a flood, and you know I don't trust that creek out there." Penelope sat down at the table. "Delvers?" She searched his face for clues to the unfamiliar word. Raymond sat opposite her. "That's what my dad used to call them. Delvers. Said they live in the ground." He took a bite of a cookie. "Course, I thought it was just another one of his tall tales, at least. I did till last night. Those kids we saw weren't regular kids, Mama. Dad said they'd been heard of around here ever since his grandfather's time, and maybe before that, though he'd only seen them once, or thought he did. He saw the holes all right. The Delvers didn't show up too often, but when they do, they dig holes. Don't know what they dig 'em for, but they only do it when the creek gets real high." Penelope felt a smile try to climb up onto her face. "Is that supposed to be the truth, Raymond?" she asked softly. "Or is it some kind of fairy tale? Now, did you ever know me to tell fairy tales?" Raymond asked sharply. But he wouldn't look at her. He kept his eyes busy watching his fingers break up a couple of cookies into little pieces. Her smile arrived. "Well, you used to tell Tammy and Bobby tall tales about yourself, about Ichabod Crane and the Headless Horseman." She gave him a knowing look. Raymond's face was pained. "That was just for fun, Mama." "Yes," she answered soothingly, "but it's hard to tell when you're joking." Raymond chased cookie crumbs around on the tablecloth with his finger. Penelope figured his feelings were hurt. While she was still wondering what to think, he asked, "What's for dinner, Mama?" Penelope set about cooking. He'd get over his sulk. Once she was good and busy, Raymond went into the living room. After a few minutes, he called, "Mama, come here and bring the binoculars." She turned the fire down on the way. "Here you are." "It's them, all right." Raymond took the binoculars and stared out into the night. She poked him in the side. "Let me see." He moved over about an inch. She squeezed in beside him at the window. Rain rippled the glass, but she could see that the diggers were there again, indistinct in the last light of the dark day. Raymond kept watching, shifting from foot to foot. Penelope figured his knees were hurting from the damp weather. She squinted into the darkness. The small figures seemed to be all the same size and moved in loose-limbed unison, like a little boy's drill team. "Still looks like kids to me." Raymond scratched his head. "Yeah, maybe so, if you say so." He sounded a bit sarcastic. "But it's funny," Penelope pondered, "how they all look so much alike." "I suppose..." Raymond stared down his nose at her, looking playful and annoyed at the same time. "It's the dirt. Uniform layer of dirt, you see. But none of them had a bath this year. Supper ready?" It was. They went into the kitchen. Raymond set the binoculars firmly on top of the refrigerator, knocking a couple of leaves off the coleus. Penelope wondered why he so badly wanted to convince her that those weren't just kids out there. She wished she could get a look at the children by daylight. She served the food and they ate without conversation. Raymond was dunking a molasses cookie in his coffee when something clanked on the porch, and Penelope heard small feet running away. She smiled to herself. Then there was a rumbling sound and a flash of lightning out in the yard. After the blue-white glare had faded, there was a much smaller flash of red. Red? Had something caught fire? Penelope got up to look, snagging the binoculars on the way. Out on the porch, the cookie bowl was gone. of the diggers and of the red light and its source, she could see nothing. "Raymond, what was that red flash?"
Oh, lightning, I guess. His voice was still tight, impatient. He joined her at the door and she linked her arm through his. She hoped the kids would make it home all right. Poor things, with no one to care how they came or went. Lightning flashed again, followed by a momentary red glow from the brush pile. It seemed to Penelope that the flash burned an image onto her eyes, a tableau of 6 or 7 small, shaggy, dark figures, all about 4 feet tall, with nondescript tatters for clothing. Raymond grunted and flipped the wall switch, turning on the 200-watt porch light. Little dark figures straightened up all at once like startled guppies and ran off silently in step. Raymond chuckled as he watched them run. "That's right," he said. "Get out of here." They were headed for the woodlot again. Penelope was taken aback by the sight. The more she saw of them, the stranger they looked. Maybe Raymond was right. Maybe she shouldn't doubt him. Delvers, Raymond. What did your father say delvers do beside dig holes? Another pulse of unmistakably red light. Raymond huffed. He didn't say, but I think we're about to find out. Lightning flashed again, and Penelope saw the delvers coming back. This time, not with shovels, but with strangely carved and decorated wooden sticks, long as their little arms. All highly polished and banded with gleaming silver. She marveled. What have they got there? Without answering, Raymond gently detached her hand from his arm and limped stiff-kneed toward the cellar door. Penelope knew he kept his shotgun behind that door. But the delvers didn't come up to the house. They jumped into the holes. One of them turned around and waved his stick at the porch light. A tiny flicker of thin red lightning crackled across the yard with a soft sound like a piece of cellophane being discreetly crumpled. It disappeared into the porch light, which popped loudly and went out. This left the yard in darkness, except for the little square of yellow light from the kitchen that spilled out around Penelope as she stood in shocked silence in the doorway. Raymond came back with the shotgun, and Penelope's heart sank. "Raymond, don't!" But she broke off at the challenge of his level eyes and lifted chin. And because out there in the darkness, she heard a deep, loud growling as of many dogs, and a splashing, sucking stomp of huge feet that shook the ground and rattled the house windows. Something large and heavy was advancing up the hill from the creek. She shivered. A clod of mud crashed through the kitchen window over the washing machine, leaving the red-checked curtains shredded by broken glass and the rain blowing in. Penelope gasped. Raymond stepped in front of her, the gun broken open over his arm. "Get down, Mama." She stepped back a little. Red lights continued to crackle in the yard. A cloud of mud whacked the side of the house. The thermometer outside the broken window fell and shattered, tinkling on the stones below. Raymond's fingers trembled as he leaned forward with the binoculars. Still, he did not close the gun. "What's there, Raymond?" "It's a great, big, wet thing." He swallowed, shuffled nervously on the kitchen floor, but still kept the binoculars trained on the yard. "Shooting rocks and stuff at us and the kids. It's about 7 feet tall, and it's all drippy, and it keeps... Well, you can hear it growling, can't you? Ain't deaf yet, are you? Don't sass me." But she knew he was just trying to cover up his fear. Something struck the side of the house, shaking the wall. Raymond's voice lost its edge. "Call the police, Mama." The phone, when she picked it up, was dead. No dial tone. Whatever was out there, they were alone with it. Raymond grunted and turned off the kitchen light so they could see into the night outside. The monster stomped its way up the hill, growling like a power saw. Penelope could now see that it looked like a many-limbed sprawl, an elephantine centipede. It seemed like a nightmare sculpture constructed of mud and rotten leaves, with rain for blood, its whole being propelled by sonorous anger. Its stench was captured by the damp air, and she gagged at the odor of decay. The little delvers were still crackling away at the creature with those curiously sculpted and adorned wooden sticks. "How do they do that?" Penelope whispered. The thing from the creek growled and flailed and stomped and shook the ground, hurling mud and stones at the delvers, who dodged as best they could. Mud hit the screen door, spattering Penelope's legs and the kitchen floor. "Get out of the doorway," Raymond snapped, still not raising the gun. He scowled as if weighing a grave decision. Lightning continued to flash in the sky and to be answered by red flares from the woodlot and tiny branched flickers from the delver staves. Penelope's hair rose on the back of her neck. Had they set fire to the brush pile? A pretty good trick after 3 nights of rain. Why did they stay out there? Her eyes were getting used to the darkness. She saw the monster raise one thick, dripping limb and throw something at the little beings in the holes. There was a crack and a splat, like the sound of a melon being dropped on stone. For a few seconds, no more red light splashed. Penelope scooted past Raymond out onto the porch. "Are you hurt?" she called. "Poor little things." There was no answer. Raymond burst through the door. The shotgun boomed as he fired into the air. As she watched, more delvers hurried down from the pasture. It looked like the entire third grade from the central school, at least 100 of them, jogging toward the battleground, taking up positions among the original fighters. They, too, aimed threads of red lightning at the monster, which began to steam and to drop bits of itself on the ground. The creature stopped coming. As the red light hit it over and over, it swiped with a crumbling appendage at what might have been its face. Thunder rumbled, and the sky lit up for a moment. Penelope shivered as the last shreds of doubt left her. The little yellow-eyed faces turned up toward the monster were not those of children. They were, as Raymond had said earlier, dark and shaggy, but they had an aged, weathered look, more of bark and twigs than flesh and blood. Raymond was right about the dirt, but it was just a rough, woodsy dirt. She could smell it now, in spite of the monster's stench. Raymond took fresh aim. "Get back now, Mama." She didn't move. The wet thing lifted its arm again and flung a chunk of itself right at her. Stones ripped through the screen, one grazing Penelope's ear. She retreated to the sink, got a piece of paper towel, and wiped blood from her ear. When no more stones flew in, she peeked around the door frame again. The delvers held their ground. The monster was falling apart. Cut by tiny lightning, hunks of it seemed to break off and tumble into the grass. Like a melting snowman, it threw no new clods. From its dismembered mass, a rank, slimy odor continued to rise. Raymond steadied himself, and the shotgun boomed again. The other barrel. Penelope watched bits of monster fly apart like sopping leaves and clumps of mud, scattering back down the hill to be washed into the creek by the rain. "How long, I wonder," Raymond mused, "till that thing puts itself back together under the water?" His eyes met Penelope's, but she looked away quickly. Never turning back, the little soldiers climbed out of their holes and trotted off toward the woodlot. Raymond drew Penelope back inside. "You all right?" "I guess," she nodded. "You?" "Yep." "What are they, Raymond?" "What I said they were." He headed for the cellar to put away the shotgun. Whatever they were, they had put up a real struggle. Were any of them hurt? Were any still out there suffering in the cold? Had they left anything behind? Any clues to help a person know them? She helped herself to Raymond's jacket again, put on her hat, and went outside. The brush pile was glowing fiercely now, and by its light Penelope could see that one hole was still occupied by a small body that looked achingly like a sleeping child. Its skull showed a narrow wound oozing dark fluid. She bit her lip, stifling horror, and picked up the little delver. It weighed not more than a soaky, wet 8-year-old child, but it was a limp and awkward burden. She could not tell if it was breathing, nor could she guess if it was the kind of thing that ought to be. If you were human, I'd take you to the hospital. But it was not human. She did not know what it was. Hey, she called, starting after the others. What about him? She carried the little creature to the woodlot, maybe 50 steps. She looked for his companions, but didn't see them. The good, clean, earthy smell she had noticed before was strongest of all here. The brush pile was not burning. Something inside it was glowing. A brighter space appeared at one side of the pile, as if a door had opened. She could not see inside, but she could feel dozens of little yellow eyes watching, dozens of child-sized creatures waiting for her next move. She set her burden down, very gently, by the bright spot, and backed away, shielding her eyes from the intensity of the light. "Don't forget your friend," she called, her voice hoarse with pity and wonder. Nothing happened for a minute or so. It was pretty cold outside, and she figured there was nothing more that she could do. So she started for the house. A few paces away, Penelope turned around for a last look. The light swelled and faded a bit, but the little body was gone. About the time she reached the corner of the house, there was a low whoosh and whir, followed by a roar of wind and a loud clatter as sticks and brush were strewn over the yard. A faint red glow remained in the woodlot, but she could see that no dark, lumpy pile of brush obscured the horizon between the bare trees. The red light winked out, leaving the night pitch black and quiet. No more running feet, no more growling. She noticed, after a few moments, that the storm had ended, too. In the silence, she heard a familiar sound, the ringing of the empty cookie bowl as it rolled from the woodlot down toward the house.